1983 marked the first recorded AIDS death in Nevada. Back then, AIDS led to verbal and physical attacks on the LGBTQ community throughout the country. Laws were enacted to criminalize those who might have transmitted HIV to another person. But that's changing. Earlier this year, the Nevada legislature passed Senate Bill 275, removing criminal charges for HIV transmission. And yet, the latest FBI figures show that hate crime against LGBTQ were 17% of all hate crimes nationally in 2019, and the number of cases in Las Vegas rose from 5 in 2018 to 22 in 2019. So almost 40 years of living with HIV in Nevada. What's it like now for the LGBTQ community? Are more protections needed? How tolerant is our culture? This weekend is the 35th Black and White Party held to support Aid for AIDS of Nevada. Antioco Carrillo is the executive director of Aid for AIDS of Nevada, which provides services to those who are HIV positive. Antioco, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having us, Joe.
Great to have you here. So, 1984, AFAN opened as a nonprofit run by volunteers. At the time, very little was known about AIDS, and that led to stigma, homophobia. Just go back there briefly. What was life like for people living with AIDS or in the LGBTQ community at the time?
I wasn't here at that time. I was alive, obviously, and I was a teenager, but mm-hmm. I was not here. But I do know that it was a sense of dread and a sense of, horrible sense in many, many ways, because people were being targeted not only for being gay, but also for being HIV positive. And there was all this misconception and this, ideas about HIV, sort of like what we first had with COVID here. It was kind of similar. This panic, this sense of dread that there is no cure, that there is no treatment, we don't know really how it's transmitted, and all of that really create a sense of panic for the community. And as a result, the response from the community was just to target the most vulnerable individuals, which was, the community, which was people with HIV/AIDS.
So that was back in the 80s, and you got here, or actually you came to AFAN in 2012. But what's it like now for people in the LGBTQ community in the Las Vegas area? I mean, is there a lot of discrimination? Are there a lot of hate crimes? What's it feel like?
Well, we live in a very volatile society, and I think anything that stands out for anyone is potentially a possibility for people to be, targeted. And although we don't see as many problems because people are not dying at the same rate as they were in the 80s, we still see some reaction from people, and we still ensure that all the information from individuals that we work with, it's completely safe. So at some point, the fact that they're not dying soon, I mean, now that people are not dying with HIV or from any complications right now, puts a little bit of relief on the challenges that we had before. There is not as many much discrimination. The LGBT community, although some people still kind of feel targeted, for the most part are very welcoming. Somebody that says that they have HIV, for the most part, nobody has a major reaction. They feel like they can support their friends. You still find some individuals that are going to be reacting in a bad way, as in anything else. We have ways in which we pay people's rent that doesn't come from us, so that the landlord does not know that we are the ones that are paying, for many reasons. One is for HIPAA regulations. The other is potentially for evictions. And right now, with what's going on, we are very, very careful as to how we interact with some of the people in the community.
You're talking about rent that you're paying for people who come to you for support and help?
Yep, for clients. Yep. We safeguard that tremendously.
So you've been with AFAN since 2012. How has AFAN changed since then?
We have modified several programs, and we have transformed our services based on the needs of the community and based on how the epidemic has changed as well. So we didn't have mental health services. We enacted mental health services. We didn't have registered dietitian. We enacted, we had a position for a registered dietitian. We started providing HIV service, HIV testing, which we didn't have before. And all of those were just moves that the direction of the organization took for to tailor the services and the needs of the community. Because we, I remember when we started doing testing, it was as a result of the need from the community. In every other major metropolitan area, you will go and you will call that organization, such as AFAN, and you will ask to get tested, and you will come in anywhere else, except for Vegas, because the laws were different. And so one of the conversations that we had with the state, with the health department, and with several other entities was about modifying that so that individuals, organizations like ours, were able to provide testing, because after a long weekend, we will get tons of phone calls from people that will say, I got exposed. Mm. I put myself at risk. Where do I go get tested? You're my only resource. And they were afraid to go to a government institution. Some of the services that we established as a result, just since 2012, were as a result of the needs that we saw in the community.
For more than three decades, Aid for AIDS of Nevada has been providing services like that to the HIV-positive community here in Las Vegas, Southern Nevada. The group provides support to this community, and some of that support comes in transportation, housing, food, counseling, HIV testing, and a lot more. And the 35th Black and White Party held to support Aid for AIDS of Nevada is this weekend. And I'm here with Antioco Carrillo. He's executive director of the organization. Antioco, more than 700,000 people have died of AIDS or AIDS-related causes since the beginning of the pandemic in 1981. How has our understanding of people living with AIDS changed over those 40 years?
It's changed in the sense that we know that HIV is no longer a death sentence. Obviously, with medication, with treatment, with access to treatment, people can live a long, productive life. If anything, if anybody is HIV positive or diagnosed with HIV, what we have a tendency to see is that they're more prone to be poor in the sense that now there's a lot more medical bills. There's a lot more access to doctors. If you don't have health insurance, that's going to be a problematic. And so eventually, you know, the money that you used to use on a monthly basis to cover your cost may not be stretched, but the bills may be. So at some point, that's where we come in. In the past, obviously, we know that it was a death sentence and people were afraid of dying and talking about it. Now it's more about really what is my life going to look like as I transition into living with HIV.
Give me an example or an idea of how much it does cost right now for a month to live with HIV.
Without insurance, you probably won't be able to afford the medication.
How much are the medications?
You know, thousands of dollars. I don't have the exact figure okay. right now because it changes, and that's part of what we do. We have access to programs that allows people to access medication through the state, but it's still expensive. And so the last thing we want to do is to put people at a place where they can not afford medication so that they inevitably they give up and they don't go into medical treatment.
And you provide that?
Yes. Absolutely. So we part of what we do also in terms of when we do medical case management is to follow up with individuals that fall out of care. Because for us, those are the crucial ones. If we keep you in care, if you keep you accessing any of the ports of healthcare, of the healthcare system that we have, we are more likely to keep you healthier than if you just all of a sudden are no longer accessing services. That means if you in 6 months you haven't checked in with your nurse, with your doctor, or with your case manager, and we don't know where you are, if you lost your place of residence, or if you have issues with food, or any of those things, the intensity of the case manager for management for us is to ensure that none of the clients fall out of care.
I'm here with Antioco Carrillo. He's Executive Director of Aid for AIDS of Nevada and the 35th Black and White Party held to support Aid for AIDS of Nevada is this weekend. I want to go to something we talked about in the introduction. Senate Bill 275 repealed a Nevada statute that makes it a felony for someone who has tested positive for HIV to intentionally engage in contact that is likely to transmit the disease. And that's directly from the bill. That's why it sounded kind of jargony there. But what does passage of that bill mean for people who live with HIV and AIDS in this state?
I think it changes the paradigm for all of us. And I want to thank a lot of the individuals that were involved crucially in the passage of that bill. Some of them are friends of mine. Some of them are people that I know very well. But we had been screaming about this for several years, because when you have some sort of an element that prevents people from disclosing their information because of the fear of being brought to charges, I think that part of what happens is that it prevents people from accessing services and feeling better about themselves. Part of it is you get individuals that don't disclose their information for many reasons, and they're seen as if they have the plague. And it's always been a challenge for them to kind of get rid of the stigma. Years ago, we started having conversations about repealing the law because we were one of the states that in which half of the rest of the states had laws against it. And I remember part of what the challenges were. People will not want to get tested because they did not want to know the results. And they didn't want to know the results because they if they suspected that they were positive, they were afraid that somebody was going to bring charges to them. So they lived in this very challenging, you know, unsure time, and they will end up very, very sick. The fact that people are not able to be targeted by potentially, you know, charges makes them feel that they can access services, that they're no longer marked. This is what they have told me, a lot of the individuals that also worked in repealing this law. They felt that they were marked. Automatically, you become HIV positive and you become potentially a criminal. And no other condition has ever given that status to individuals that suffered it. And so it is another form of discrimination, how it was managed.
Are there other or similar laws in Nevada that you're targeting now? Or is there anything else like this?
No, but you have to look at it from a different perspective. When we start looking at HIV, as we see everything else, there are laws that are enacted and they're put in place based on what you see at the moment that you have that crisis. And like, for instance, in the case of HIV, everybody was afraid in the 80s, in late 80s, of HIV. We didn't know that there was treatment, cure, any of that stuff. We didn't know that we were going to come this far. So the laws that were put in place at that time stayed in the books, but it never transformed. But what transformed was the epidemic. What transformed was the face of HIV. What transformed was the fact that people were living longer and healthier lives. And so as a result of that, when you see is that there are laws that have been enacted at the time that they needed to be enacted for fear and other reasons, and then 30 years later, they're obsolete and they're used to cause harm to individuals. And so as we move forward, it was the same thing with foster care system. Individuals that were trained to be in the foster care system to be foster care parents, in the 80s at that time, also there was a regulation that said that if you're HIV positive, you cannot be a foster care parent. And so it took a couple, you know, individuals, one of them was positive, and they were apparently the perfect couple. They were denied the custody, and so they decided to take matters into their own hand and started changing things. I think that what happens is that we look at laws and regulations as they emerge. Nobody has had the time to go back. I think that the only one that was very clear that everybody always complained about was about the fact that if you are HIV positive, you're asked to sign a document stating that if you pass the virus from one person to the next, you are going to be potentially in jail, in prison for up to 10 years and blah, 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 you know, thousands of dollars in fines. That was really a mark.
Let's talk about the Black and White Party. The first Black and White Party happened in the summer of 1987. Back then, the price of admission was a can of food for the food shelter. Talk a little bit about the history. What's behind that black and white can of food way back then?
Well, because it was a cheap can. It was a generic can of food.
When generics were black and white?
Yes, yes. That was the reason. That's the main reason.
Is that the reason for the party's name as well?
Yes. That was what it was. When people got together, it was because we wanted to ask people to bring people, you know, at the time, at AFAN, they wanted to bring food. And obviously, we're talking about the same amount of time. It was discrimination. People didn't want to help. And so the easiest way to help is if you come to this party and you just bring these cans, generic. If you make them normal, that's fine. But generic cans are also welcome. So it was a black and white. And for a period of time, the party was called the generic party, the generic black and white party. Hmm. And so that was the reason it kept the name. And that was the reason it evolves. It evolved from an apartment somewhere in Henderson to what we see that as the annual extravaganza that everybody looks forward to go.
As HIV and AIDS has fallen out of the headlines, and as we have drugs now that can control it at least, do fewer people come to the party?
No. No, because it's a staple. I think it's the party happens on a yearly basis. And every year is better than the year before. But I think that the difference is that our event, some people call it the gala. It's not a gala. It's a form of our gala because we don't have people sitting at the table and waiting for a plate of food to come over. We don't have all these speeches all the time. We want people to be the party. So we ask people to come to the event dressed in black or white, with as much black and white as they can or as little as they can get away with. This is Vegas after all, right? And so what we do is to mingle, to go and talk to other people, to take selfies, to try the food from several restaurants that we have. People, the restaurants are giving us samples. They're giving everyone samples. And some vendors from liquor companies are also giving samples as well. And so people are able to just be in this atmosphere of a carnival where everybody is dressed in black and white right at the time that you have all these entertainers from this trip that come on a yearly basis dedicated to just entertain, you know, the attendees and bring their best of what Vegas has to offer to the party.
The last time you had the party was 2 years ago. Last year it was called off because of the pandemic. It's really known throughout the community, the Black and White Party, and the event gets a lot of coverage locally in the media. Do you think that could have been possible 35 years ago?
No. No.
Why not?
Because there was not enough acceptance. There was not enough acceptance of what it was like for people to just be themselves. And obviously the major supporters of this event are the gay community and individuals also that are not LGBT part of the community also attend because they know it's safe and they know it's fun and they know it's engaging and they have the best time of their lives. But we are seeing with the changes of, you know, marriage equality and in all the changes that we've seen in society, we have seen a shift on how people have been able to overlook all this difference that they used to see. We don't see that this support was going to be the same 35 years ago. The first black and white party that I went to was in 1994, and it was probably 300 people at the most.
And what is it now?
Over 2,500 people.
So this event really celebrates the LGBTQ community while supporting Aid for AIDS of Nevada. Why does Aid for AIDS of Nevada still need that support?
Because we still have people getting infected. We still have people accessing services. We still have people that have been infected for a long time. And as we talked about earlier, you know, their economic circumstances shift and they need us to be present to support them. We still have people that need education, education about medicine. We still have people that need mental health. We still have people that need all the services that we provide in light of having to deal with HIV, you know, since the mid-80s, right? The epidemic has changed and the services have changed and they will continue to change. So if there is a cure next year, we will still need support for the ones that are in the system to transition out of the system.